Hello and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plato, and my very own oil leak. It's Dave Vitti.
Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance.
Now, don't forget to press subscribe on YouTube so that you'll never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from. David, Dave, how are we?
I'm very good. Thank you, Jace. Jason, how are you?
Yeah, enjoying the sunshine, actually.
Absolutely. And you're looking quite summery and sunshiny in your, what would you describe that colour as? Is it yellow? Is it kind of custard?
It's hearing aid beige.
Hearing aid beige. Well, yes. It suits you. It looks nice.
It's a classic.
It looks summery, and I'm sure that today's special guest will appreciate. Because he's a gentleman that appreciates design and the finer things in life and whatnot. And I think what you're wearing is completely on point.
Oh, well, that's very good. That's good to know. Well, our guest today is a gentleman who's responsible for buying and selling some of the finest and rarest cars on the planet. His showroom, well, it's like an Aladdin's came of automotive exotica and the stuff of motoring dreams. It is, of course, the impeccably turned out Mr. Tom Hartley Jr. Hi, Tom. How are we?
Very well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me onto your podcast. And I've been looking forward to it. And for what it's worth, Jason, I would call your T-shirt more of a pale primrose. I think we have an Aston Martin DB4 GT somewhere.
Oh,
you can just see it in the corner. Just see it there.
Yes.
And it would definitely match your T-shirt wonderfully well.
Primrose is what I was thinking.
I don't think my checkbook's big enough for that motor in the corner.
Well, listen, I mean, part of the reason why we did want to invite you on, Tom, is because we were sort of dying for a little nosy around your garage, actually. So there might be a little bit more of that sort of shifting of the screen and whatever, and we can have a little glance over your shoulder.
We can do a little bit of a shifting. We've got a McLaren F1 down there. We've got a Maserati MC12 that's just arrived. We've got some great Formula One cars, including Ayrton Senna's Donington winner.
Wow.
And Lewis Hamilton's first chassis he ever won. His first two races in, actually, not just his first race.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you could have a look at some exciting... Oh, I forgot the 250 LM and the 250 short wheelbase.
I mean, how could you? How could you forget those? Now, what I was going to say is, you know, as I say, we've looked on the website many times. I sort of quite often go there when I've got a spare half an hour in the afternoon. And you know, it is very much, for me, it's the sort of embodiment of the Athena posters and whatnot that we used to have on our walls in the 80s and 90s. But this is like, you know, the stuff of fantasy, but this is what you deal with on a daily basis. I suppose, you know, you were growing up around these sort of cars. So what age were you when you first started working in the showroom with your family business?
Well, obviously the family business is a separate business.
No, sure. I know. Yeah.
You know that I grew up in what was my dad's business at the time, buying and selling luxury performance cars, luxury and performance cars. And, you know, I left school when I was 11 years old. It's all quite well documented. Didn't have any type of formal education at home, didn't have a tutor, and was brought up through what was my father's business at the time. And then, you know, some 11 or 12 years ago, after being in the business for best part of 20 years, two decades, I then decided to split away from that business and set up my own enterprise.
Wowza. So, I mean, I was going to ask, as my question, was there any doubt that you were going to lead in your dad's footsteps and go into that big business, you know, in the one you're in? And I guess the answer to that is absolutely not.
Yeah, I mean, our business, yeah, I mean, I enjoyed, I was the farmer's son, I use the analogy, i.e., you know, if you're a farmer, you expect your son one day to also be a farmer.
Yeah.
For me, I didn't know anything any different. You know, if I wasn't a used car dealer, I'm not sure what I'd be. Probably not very good at anything.
So, Tom, what was it that made the decision to actually sort of branch out on your own, as it were, and sort of leave the family business and set up your own path?
It was a number of things, really. I suppose one of the most important elements was I grew up in the modern car world, you know, buying and selling wonderful cars like Porsche 911s and, you know, Bentley Arnages and Mercedes S-Classes and et cetera, et cetera. And you know, that for me, as time went by, evolved into, you know, I was getting really stimulated by the supercars. And, you know, these days people use the terminology supercar, and there's so many supercars. Where do you even start and where do you finish? And, you know, back in those days, there really weren't many supercars. The only supercars that existed was a Porsche 959, a Ferrari F40, a Jaguar XJ220, a Ferrari F50.
Yes.
And that was it.
Yeah, that's
like
true.
There was no such thing as Pagani, Koenigsegg, and, you know, the whole host of list of different cars that manufacturers have launched since. And, you know, those were the cars that used to get me really excited as a young boy, and never used to see them very often. And to see one, actually, you never used to see one out. Like these days, you see more F40s on the road these days than you used to see in the late 1990s.
Yes.
And then that evolved from, you know, we had a huge market share of modern supercars because of how much I was focusing in my attention on those cars at that time. You know, at that time, we were buying and selling more Ferrari Enzos than anybody in the world, and the likes of the F40s. And then that sort of, my next path was into more historic cars, classic cars. And when you start reading about classic cars and the places they've been, the people that they've seen, you know, the people that have owned the cars, the history that they made by some of the great race cars, you know, you suddenly go back to dealing with a even a wonderful Porsche Carrera GT or something, and it just it isn't as rewarding or as stimulating. And then I would find myself that, you know, I remember once buying a Ferrari 250 short wheelbase from a guy in New York, and we flew the car over and we put it on our website, and I clicked on our website one day and I saw like Range Rovers and Porsche 911 997 Turbo and Ferrari 250 short wheelbase and it just didn't quite feel right. And, you know, my father was never into old cars, not interested in old cars, respectfully had no knowledge on old cars. And I thought we needed, you know, the business needed to be slightly diversified, where we needed to have a focus on very collectible cars and then still a focus on modern cars. And then my dad and I have a habit of disagreeing.
I think that's true with all dads and sons, isn't it?
So we disagree about most things. And then, you know, it was one of those things where I thought, I'm not sure where this is going and what's going to happen in 5 years' time or 10 years' time. And I want to build something that's, you know, I had a vision on what a business, the ideal car business should be, and focusing on the greatest cars in the world. And that's what I wanted to create.
Well, I mean, it's certainly, you know, I follow you, you know, your website and your Twitter feeds and everything. And there's some beautiful, amazing historic cars which have gone through your hands, if you like. What would you say, is the, most memorable historic, maybe even the most expensive car which has gone through your system? And we don't want to be rude and talk about numbers, but what would you say is the car, if you had to pick one, which has gone through the books?
Do you know, it is utterly bonkers on the car. Like today we concluded a transaction on a McLaren F1.
Right.
And the car is actually, I don't know if you can... you probably can't quite see it anyway. It's just around that corner. But and, you know, it's a huge ticket car. And, you know, it's got to a stage. We sell so many wonderful cars that the rest of the team here just consider it extremely normal. You know, I am a car pervert. And, like, you know, I still get very excited by every car that we trade of that level. Because I just think how special the car is, how important it is, how privileged we are to be involved in handling those cars. But, you know, Jason, we've sold three Ferrari 250 GTOs. We've sold the most important Ferrari 250 Testarossa on two separate occasions.
Wow.
You know, these are cars that are like north of 60 million.
Good
and, you know, up until recently, I would have said to you that the most important car was the 250 Testarossa, because it was chassis 0704, the only unrestored example, the car that won Buenos Aires, the car that won Sebring. I had all great drivers like Olivier Gendebienne and Mike Hawthorne and all the great people drive it in period.
Yeah.
But then a couple of years ago, I bought a Ferrari 250 GTO.
Yeah.
And we decided before we were going to sell the car, we decided to do a total restoration.
Good Lord.
And the original body had been separated from the car many decades ago, but still remained with the car.
Right.
And we decided to reunite the original body, do a total restoration. And when we started to embark on this process and then dive into the history of the car and to think that the success that this car had in period, and it was a Ferrari 250 GTO that was born in blue, not retail red. You know, it had a unique color interior. Everything about it was so spectacular.
Yeah.
I would say that that would probably take the cake at the moment.
Good Lord. And in terms of the restoration, do you do that work yourselves in-house or have you got a team of specialists outside suppliers?
We have cars all over the world that are being restored. However, we don't actually restore any cars in-house because the different genre of cars that we deal in is quite unique amongst car dealers or brokers. You know, we sell lots of Formula One cars, Grand Prix cars.
Do you need specialists in each area of that car, don't you?
You know, if you go to the very best Ferrari mechanics in the world and you give them a Porsche 2.7 RS, they can find their way around it.
Yes.
But they're not experts on the model. So we would end up having to employ the whole bloody world, car business, to be able to take care of our cars.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the other thing is, you know, there's a lot of people out there who claim to restore cars themselves, other dealers, and they really don't. You know, they send their bodies off to a specialized body builder, a body repairer. Yeah. They send the paintwork off to a specialized paint shop. And they just bring it all back. And the only thing that's done from themselves is an invoice. And so, you know, we would rather be very transparent with people and say, look, your Ferrari should go to Italy. The best people to restore that in Italy. And our own cars, you know, we have 21 of our own cars in restoration at the moment.
Wow.
Okay.
Wow.
So, you know, Tom, when you're making some pretty serious business decisions in terms of whether to buy a particular car and indeed at what price, do you often already have in mind who you might sell it to through your network? You know, do you kind of think, I guess it's a bit like snooker in a way, you're almost thinking two and three shots ahead. You think, if I get that, I think that so-and-so would be perfect for it. Does it work like that or not?
You can't help, if you live and breathe your business, that when, like today, I'm looking here now, somebody offered me a car a couple of hours ago, and I'm thinking that if we do procure that car, you know, I'm thinking of a couple of people off the top of my head who I would fancy being interested in it.
Yes.
However, look, you know, I would never buy a car thinking that I was certainly going to sell it to somebody, because you'd end up being skint if that was the case. Because, you know, I'll give you all the viewers a THJ motto is that no deal is done until the money is in the bank. You take it back out the bank, count it, and put it back in the bank. because you know, I've been in business for long enough to realize that somebody saying, I will buy one of those cars if you get one in, compared to actually sending the money, doing the deal, are two very different things.
I must admit, I've always subscribed to that view, but you've added an extra layer on, which is taking the money out of the bank, counting it, and putting it back. I might just take that on board, actually.
I suppose the secret really is just to know that even if you do have somebody or some people in mind who may be interested in that car, I suppose the decision is always going to be that you want to buy something that you know that you can sell on at a good price, whether it's to that person or just to somebody else on the market, isn't it? You know, it's got to make financial sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, but what for me, where our business is totally unique is, how do you know it makes financial sense? Like the cars that we operate in, the cars that we deal in, you know, there's no Glassy's guide for them. But basically, it all comes down to market knowledge. it all comes down to gut feeling. And ultimately, in my business, that comes down a lot to me. Like, it's, I live and breathe the business for 18 hours a day, 7 days a week. And, you know, hey, we get some cars wrong. Like, we buy some cars sometimes and lose, you lose hundreds of thousands. But, you know, this, like, you've got to just go by your gut feeling. And over time, if you get more right than wrong, then you've got a good business. And if you get more wrong than right, then you're not in business.
And I guess it's down to the quality of the car, isn't it? You know, if you're lucky enough to find the right car, then that's going to be, that's a good, that's the deal, isn't it?
We, I try and focus on just the very best of anything. So all of our cars, they don't all have to be $60 million. Like, we, you know, we will sell a Mini Cooper 500 and, if it's the lowest mileage Mini in the world, we always have Land Rover Defenders in stock because I love those last of the line of the old Land Rover Defenders, like the Heritage, the Adventure, the Autobiography, because they're collectible. They're cars that I like. And that's another thing that's important is I really believe in only buying. I only like to buy cars that I actually like and believe in myself. Because when you come to sell the cars, it's so much easier to sell. It's like a Ferrari Boxer. I am definitely the world's worst salesman ever of a Ferrari Boxer. Every time we buy one, we lose money in it and we keep it in stock for years because every time somebody's interested in it and they go, hey, so, okay, what do you think about this? And you go, it's a shocking car, like, I don't get them. And then they go, oh, really? Why not? And then it's like, okay, I'll have a think about it, Tom, and I'll let you know. And you never hear from them ever again. So I like to just, every car that you ever see that we have in stock, I like and I believe in. And if I don't believe in it, I'd rather not put our money in it.
I would imagine trust is an important word in your business, Tom. And I suppose that works both ways in terms of the fact that the customers obviously need to trust you and your team in terms of getting the right car at the right price. But also, you need to trust those that you're acquiring your vehicles from in terms of their history and their provenance and everything. Trust must be, it's a crucial part of what you do, isn't it?
At this end of the market, in the end of the market that we deal in, I would say the majority of the time we are dealing with, you know, very special individuals, very, you know, just nice people of the world, genuine people of the world. We would never rely on an owner or a client on the history of their car, because that's our job as experts to research that history before we buy it. And, you know, we come across loads of cars, lots of cars, where people think they were probably missold the car a little bit when they bought it. And they think that they've got a car that's got its original engine and they've owned the car for 25 years and we inspect it and we're like, that's not the original engine. And, you know, the chassis number's completely wrong on it. And, you know, we've seen and witnessed a lot of unusual things that, you know, go on over the years. So that's our responsibility, really, in order to be super diligent to know what we're buying. And that's really the onus is on us there. What the onus is not on us with is with regards to title. You know, at the end of the day, if Jason states it's his car, and he's signing a contract to say it's his car, then it bloody better be his car. So, you know, that's something that we trust, rely on. And then I think when people, I think there's more trust involved when people are buying from us, because it's unbelievable how many cars we sell where people never inspect or never visit us. I have no idea why we're building this new showroom we're building, because, you know, our 30 cars that we sell, I would say 1 in 30 visit us, or 1 in 30 send someone to inspect a car for them.
Is that right?
Yeah, wow. 1 in 30 of any level, any car, any level. And
well, actually, that's quite a feather in your cap, isn't it, really, when you think about it? That you know, they trust you know, your knowledge and what you're saying about the car.
Yeah, but you only misdescribe something once in life. Like this end of the market, it's a very small world. And, you know, if THJ tells you how beautiful the car is and then you get it and it's not so beautiful, is going to annoy you, piss you off,
yeah, yeah.
and you're going to be quick to be able to tell your friends or talk about it at a dinner.
Yeah,
and
word gets around quick, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So it takes a lifetime to build a reputation, yeah. and it takes yeah. one bad deal to ruin a reputation. Ruins,
yeah. yeah, I can imagine you mentioned all the research you've got to do. You know, with some of the very old cars, the classic cars, I can imagine that's quite a task, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we take on some cars, we take we will spend dedicate weeks. Yeah. Weeks, like somewhere between 2 to 4 weeks on one particular chassis on pure research.
Good Lord. Good Lord.
Sometimes it has actually known to be even longer than that, but 2 to 4 weeks is quite common.
So, I mean, you're obviously a car fan. You've admitted that yourself. But, you know, you're a trader. You're a dealer. Out of all the cars you've got, personal cars, are they always up for sale at the right price? Or are there some which, no way, they're here to stay?
Actually, I've sold very, very few of my own personal cars. So obviously I have cars that I buy through my business yep. that are stock cars.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then I have cars that I buy personally.
Yes.
I view those personal cars, I'm probably sharing, I don't know if I'm sharing too much or not, but I view those personal cars as my pension fund. You know, mm-hmm. people talk about pension funds and I don't really want, you know, Mike at the bank to invest money for me when yeah. I don't know what he's investing in. He might not know what he's investing in.
Sure.
Where I believe in the car market, and the reason why these cars are not for sale is not because I'm one of those people that might go, no, I would never sell that at any money. You know, that's so sentimental to me.
Sure.
It's just I would not dream of selling it because I believe they've got a much better future.
Yes.
So, you know, I have a Ferrari 288 GTO, which is the oldest 288 GTO in existence. It was
wow.
one of the prototypes. Enzo Ferrari himself gifted it to the head of Ferrari Formula One for his bonus for the 1983 season. And then I bought it from him. So it was a one-owner car, and it was all wow. documented going from Enzo to him.
Fantastic.
And when I bought that car, I paid such a world record price for it. And you know, I just wanted to own it, and I've never had it for sale. And now it looks like such a clever buy financially because the market's moved up so much on them. But I don't think they've stopped. Like, I think those cars in, you know, another 10 years' time, I think they've still got a bright future. Yeah. I've got, you know, an F40 that was delivered new to Stirling Moss that's done 4,000 miles from new. And, you know, again, I was using it this weekend and somebody said to me, I bet you'd never sell that car. And the reason I wouldn't sell it, you know, there's part of me that is, I am a dealer and, you know, make me an offer. I might sell the house and move out tomorrow and tell the wife that all the handbags have gone with it. But
No, you wouldn't.
but you know, I wouldn't dream of selling it at the moment just because I don't think they, now's not the time to be selling them.
Yeah.
Do you know what? I think I'm not an electric car fan, but I think the way the world is going, I think it's going to go even bigger in the world. You know, these amazing cars, which we'll look back on. I mean, you know, I remember Eddie Irvine had a 288 GTO, and I used to see him in Oxford a few times in it. Those sorts of cars are just going to go stratospheric, aren't they?
Yeah. His car is an interesting car. The chassis of it actually is traded hands a lot of times. It's had a few bumps along the way.
Yeah.
I think the real analog great supercars, the F40, the GTO,
yeah.
You know, those cars, I think have got a bright future ahead. Even McLaren F1s, F1s, you know, they're now stratospheric level of value, but you know, they're not even half the price of a 250 GTO.
Yes.
You know, yeah. they're closer to a third of the price of a Ferrari 250 GTO.
Yeah.
And you know, a 250 GTO is the Rembrandt of classic cars. It's the old master. It's the car that stood the test of time. It's the most wonderful car to drive.
Yeah.
But younger generations that come through, I reckon if I said to my youngest son, would you prefer to have the McLaren F1 or the 250 GTO? You know, he'll probably pick the F1.
Mm, and yeah.
So for that reason, you would think that an F1 has still a very bright future.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I was going to ask you actually about the future and sort of the fact that you mentioned your kids, because obviously, you know, you grew up as a young boy through that family business and it sort of like set you on this path. Is there a follow on in terms of your children? Do you see them going into the car world, or are they not interested?
Well, my daughter's already in the business.
Right.
So she's 17. She left school last year. Mm-hmm. She completed GCSEs, done us all very proud, because nobody in our family is very well educated. All we can do is add up the price of a car. She done well across all subjects. And then she decided she wanted to come into the business, which was really nice to hear that she was a push to do it. Mm-hmm. And she's working at the moment. She's sort of on a... she's rotating around the office. So she's working okay. very closely with our accounts department, and then she's working with client services, and she's getting a good feel for
all the different room. Factions. Yeah, yeah.
Which is good experience. Mm. And our oldest son, Tom, who's 13, whenever he's not at school, if he has a school holiday, he travels with me everywhere and he comes to the office every day.
Okay.
So this weekend he was working with our head detailer, and he was detailing a Ferrari F40 that we've just purchased.
Wow!
That's done 10,000 miles from new, and our head detailer likes to dismantle these cars. So he sort of dismantled it. The doors are off, the rear engine lid's off, the front's off, and I walked in there, and there Tom was with a machine polisher polishing the car. And I said, "Tom, for God's sake, please don't go through the paintwork. That's optional." He's like, "No, Dad, I know what I'm doing." I said, oh. And last week he was taking calls. He was sat at my desk and he was taking calls. We were in the office together on a Saturday, and it was only the two of us. And he was taking calls with clients that were calling in, and he was asking how he could help. And he tried to sell one of them a Land Rover Defender.
Brilliant.
So yeah, he's starting on the right path.
Oh, that's great, isn't it?
The apple doesn't fall far from the tree, as they say.
Yeah. Hey, so what car do you get the Sainsbury's in then?
Today it's an Audi RS6. Mm-hmm. Historically always had RS6s.
Yeah.
But then we're building a new showroom at the moment, and because we're always down on site, I swapped it for a Land Rover Defender, the new model Land Rover Defender, which I really like.
Yeah.
Anyway, I've now swapped back to an RS6 because I missed the RS6. So.
I've got a real fancy for an RS6 Avant. Great motors, aren't they?
Well, they do everything, don't they? That's the thing.
Yeah. What's your favourite cars, the two of you? What's your favourite era of car?
Good question. I've always been a bit of a BMW man myself, to be honest with you. So I kind of like the E36s and stuff like that. You know, it's sort of my era, I suppose. But still haven't owned one. Jason says that I need to own one at some point in my life. I've not got my hands on one yet.
Oh, yeah, you've got to. They're good. They're good bits of kit. I've always been a Porsche man. I've had lots of turbos, turbo S's. In fact, the last one I had was the exclusive series. Was lucky to get that.
Gold or grey?
Grey.
Yeah,
really great bit of kit. For me, you know, it was my daily. They make the best cars in the world in terms of, you want something really quick, dead easy to get on with. It's German, it works. And also, I felt, if you drive around a Ferrari, everybody is in your face. In a 911, you can just waft through and people really don't notice you. And I quite like that.
Yeah.
I think it's also very telling. We've had this conversation before, Jason, haven't we? You know, when we've gone and done events and whatnot, and, you know, sort of we've all driven ourselves. And remember that one time when you turned up and Tim Harvey turned up? And I think it says a lot when professional racing drivers can obviously have anything and they choose to have a Porsche. And obviously says a lot in terms of, you know, what you think about them.
Yeah.
A quick bit of mid-show housekeeping just before we crack on. If you haven't already, please press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from. Tom, so is there still an itch to scratch for you? Something you've always wanted to get your hands on and never quite managed it? Or have you bought and sold pretty much everything by now?
No, certainly not. We, you know, I'd like to, by the time I hang my gloves up, I'd like to be very selfish and have bought and sold every Ferrari 250 GTO, every Ferrari 250 Testarossa, every McLaren F1, every Grand Prix winning chassis in the world. So I'm quite possessive and, yeah, ambitious. And there's about $1 trillion worth of cars that I, maybe $2 or $3 trillion worth of cars that I would love to buy and sell, which I have yet to touch. So there's so many wonderful cars out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Right. So here's a question for you. Probably impossible to answer, but let's see. If the rules on vehicle ownership, Tom, were to change, and you were only allowed one car for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Does it have to be a realistic answer, i.e. if it had to be a realistic answer that I've got to take my family out in it, I've got to take the kids to school, and if I want to go and play golf, I need to put the golf clubs in the boot, then I'm obviously going to say an Audi RS6.
Okay? Good lad, yeah.
Because there's nothing better than that. But if you said, what's your dream car that you, you know, there's only one car and that's the only car you're ever allowed to own again and it's just you yourself, Tom.
Yeah. What would that
then
mean?
I think a 250 short wheelbase California Spider.
Yes.
Takes a bit of beating. I think that's a car.
You're right, though, to distinguish it, aren't you? Because as you say, you know, you're sort of thinking about what is the ultimate car for you, but then also you're thinking about the practicalities. You're not going to do the tip run in the 250, are you? So, you know, it's a different cars for different jobs.
Yeah. I probably won't do the tip run in the RS6 either, to be honest. But, you know, I was thinking more in case I had to think about the wife and kids. And giving them a lift home from somewhere.
Yeah.
They'll probably all be uncomfortable on the passenger seat of the California Spider.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's my dream car. It's such a beautiful, beautiful car.
No, they are stunning.
Amazing, amazing bit of kit.
Is there anything that you wouldn't get involved with, Tom, sort of in terms of a particular make or model? Is there anything you just kind of, for whatever reason, you don't even have to say what the reason is there anything you just kind of go, do you know what? I wouldn't go anywhere near that stuff.
If you'd asked me this question a couple of years ago, this could be a bit controversial, but if you'd have asked me that question a couple of years ago, I would have openly said a Koenigsegg.
Okay.
Right.
Because I had a terrible experience with Koenigsegg, and we have a fantastic relationship with all manufacturers. So, you know, my relationship with Ferrari is particularly strong. My relationship with McLaren is very strong. Aston Martin, everybody.
Yeah.
And because, you know, we do the job properly and, you know, we're always... we are ambassadors in a way supporting the values of their cars.
Mm-hmm.
However, I bought a Koenigsegg CCX once. I can't remember if I bought it and took it. I think I might have took it in part exchange against a Ferrari Enzo.
Mm.
And it was about 2008 or 9. And I just didn't have a very good experience with the brand. We tried to sell the car and didn't sell the car very well. I then put it at auction and sold it for quite a low price. And then Christian Koenigsegg called me up and really threw his toys out the pram and told me that I'd destroyed his brand. And I just said to him, I'm not sure how, because I've had it for sale for a year and asked you to help me try and sell it. And we haven't been able to.
Mm.
And they were very illiquid cars at that time. You couldn't sell one. And you definitely couldn't go and get a check for one.
Yeah.
However, so as over the years, I've always thought, I don't want anything to do with a Koenigsegg. Every time somebody's asked me about one, I'm like, no, I'm a Pagani man, not a Koenigsegg man.
Yeah.
But I do like the new car that they've just brought out today. And I am now looking at them thinking, as time's gone by, you know, I think he's done a very good job of his brand. And even though we don't seem to be besties and we're probably not going for dinner anytime soon, I would tip my hat to him and say that I think he's done a very good job and his cars that he's turning out now do look pretty awesome.
Mm.
Interesting.
Yeah, I must admit, I've been down to and done a bit of filming with Horatio Pagani a couple of times down in Italy. I just love what he does.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, he's like a Swiss watch, like a Bruges, or, you know, he's, everything is the detail. of his manufacture is extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, he's done a fantastic job, but he's also done equally as good a job marketing.
Yeah.
So you know, he's done a very good job of the cars that he's built, but you know, they're still. I don't know when they're going to stop building Zondas. Like there's always another Zonda that's coming out, that's being delivered, and how they've monetized that program is fantastic. How they've done, how they have monetized the upgrades and said, bring your car back to us. Like, don't let some aftermarket company come up with something on a Zonda. We'll come up with something, and you know, give us another couple of million and we'll make it 760 horsepower. And so, you know, he's done a very, very good job of his own marketing and his brand generally. You know, everybody likes him, this designer that was at Lamborghini.
That's right.
You know, and he set up his own car brand, and you know, normally it's a generational thing. Normally the first generation, it's very hard to get a car brand off the ground today, and he's well and truly got it off the ground, and he's done a great job.
He's a very interesting character, isn't he?
Yeah.
Where do you sit on electric cars?
Rubbish.
At last, a bit of sheer honesty.
Rubbish, absolute rubbish.
Yeah,
it's just so sad. You know, I'm looking out. If I look here and I'm looking underneath me, there's a 1953 Aston Martin DB3S and a 1965 Ferrari 275 and a 1956 Mercedes 300 SL Gullwing and a 1928 4.5 litre Bentley.
Yeah,
are we ever going to say? And there's a 2024 i4, like, or a Tesla Model 3 or S or whatever it's called. You know, they're just a lifed part. Like, they're now, it's like the ancillary items that you get on an engine that can be replaced.
Yes.
The car now is just a lifed part. It's like a battery. Well, it is a battery, isn't it? I'm saying it's like a battery, but it's like you replace your battery, you now replace your car.
Yeah, well, they're white goods, aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
They're like white goods.
They are. And this is, you know, we've had this conversation in various different forms, haven't we, Jason, over the years, in as much as the reason, the one thing that connects all of us on this podcast is the fact that we all love cars and always have loved cars, but it's that sort of relationship which sort of goes beyond it just being a mode of transport or a product. And the thing that electric cars don't have that obviously, you know, the internal combustion has is that ability to breathe and be alive, you know, without being too romantic about it. But I think it's very true, isn't it? You just don't get that with you know, the white goods that they're turning out today. And I don't think that they will ever be regarded in with the same affection, rather, as we do for our classic cars now.
No, I don't think so either. I think it's very sad. I also think that we may see a reverse. Like, I wouldn't write off the possibility of, you know, internal combustion engine cars coming back.
Yeah.
And, you know, all of these manufacturers who said we're going to be all electric by such a day. Mm. I mean, when did Land Rover state that they were going to be all electric? That went out the window, didn't it, quite quickly?
Yeah. Mm. And Porsche are still working on combustion engines, aren't they?
Yeah.
Because they're, you know, I think e-fuel will come, and it'll come quickly, I hope.
All synthetic fuels and, like, there's, you know, I think the German government, they pushed their ban back on electric cars. Mm. And, you know, all governments, like the UK, when they said all, you know, the only cars that's going to be allowed into city centres were going to be, I think, by 2030. Like, that's just gone. Forget about it.
Where
are they going to get all the electricity from?
I know. Cables. How people are going to charge them in streets?
Yeah.
It's bonkers, isn't it?
Give us a future tip then, Tom. Something current on the road today that you think might become highly prized or sought after in years to come. A future classic, if you will. Is there anything that you think that, you know, you've got your eye on?
I should be charging you for this.
You should be, yeah.
This isn't free. People, you know, people have forums all the time and they charge people. It's like $1,000 to $10,000 a seat to come in and learn. And you're asking free of charge.
Absolutely. What we do.
I would say it depends what your budget is. Give me a budget.
$200,000. All let's right. say that.
$200,000. By a really nice low mileage Ferrari 355 and put a bit of change in your pocket.
Yeah, yeah.
Or a really nice Porsche 993 Turbo.
Yes.
That's what I would probably, I think the 90s cars and those cars were both such good cars, so reliable from both manufacturers. Mm. The 355 was the first really reliable car from Ferrari.
Yeah.
It's a timeless modern classic.
Yeah.
I think if you keep it 10 years, I think they will do very well.
And it's arguably one of the prettiest cars I think Ferrari have ever made, actually.
I think it's a very beautiful car. It's perfectly proportioned.
Yeah.
It's nimble to drive. I think it's a very, very good car. I've been buying quite a few, but after this podcast, I'm not going to probably buy any more. So, yeah, thanks, guys.
Right, come on then. Here's the golden question, Tom. Me and Dave always think that music and cars are perfect together. So, yeah, your dream drive, where you going to, what you're listening to, and what you're driving.
I mean, I've probably already done that. So I spend quite a lot of time in Italy because we restore a lot of cars in Italy.
Yeah.
And last year I spoke earlier about a Ferrari 250 GTO that we had restored over there.
Yeah.
And last year I collected it from the Ferrari factory and I was on the snagging following the restoration. And they just gave me the keys. I pulled outside Maranello's gates, and I just headed up into the hills above Maranello and didn't see another car and just kept driving and forget music. The only music I wanted to listen to was that 3-litre V12 Colombo engine.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was pretty good. Also, another time I took a competition California Spider on the same road. That's why I took the GTO there afterwards, because I remembered what an experience it was on the Cal Spider.
Yeah.
And then also we have hosted a couple of our own car tours.
Yeah.
One around Provence in the south of France, and one in Tuscany. And the roads around Tuscany, going in and out of Florence.
Oh, stunning, aren't they?
It's just incredible. Yeah. We've nailed a few of those great drives.
Sounds perfect to me, JP.
Certainly does. Well, unfortunately, that's it for this week's Fueling Around, powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Dave, as always, so thanks to you. But a huge thanks to our special guest this week, the one and only Mr. Tom Hartley Jr. Thanks, Tom.
It's been very good to be on. Thank you for the invite. And Jason, with all this money that you've saved from Adrian Flux and this insurance, I'm expecting you to hurry up and come here and start buying some cars.
Hey, he can be one of the one in 30 that actually comes and visits.
Yeah, exactly. We've got a red carpet here waiting to go down just for the great Jason Plato to arrive.
Mate, I prefer grey carpets, actually.
I reckon they'd get the posh biscuits out for you as well, Jason.
If you went, the bourbon creams.
Absolutely. And Yorkshire Gold in your cup of tea.
We do have special mugs, actually, depending on who the client is that visits. We have the very special China. The very special China only comes out on very special occasions.
Does it really?
Very special deals.
Excellent.
But I reckon for both of you two, we could get it out.
We'll get the mugs out. Top banana.
I love it. We'll do it. Thank you, Tom. It's been a pleasure. Don't forget to press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
Thanks for listening, folks, and we'll see you next time. Ta-da.